open it to the 9th chapter of the book of Hebrews. The 9th chapter of the book of Hebrews, and we'll begin our study with the 9th chapter this morning. It's a rather lengthy chapter, but the way it flows, I think that we can go through it fairly quickly based on the fact that a lot of what is said in the 9th and part of the 10th chapter of the book of Hebrews, we've already looked at and studied when we went through the Old Testament from the book of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, talking about the establishment of the tabernacle and the priesthood, and so a lot of this is going to be very familiar with you, because what the Hebrew writer is doing, as we said when we began this study, his intention was to stem the tide of apostasy. The book of Hebrews is really no different than the book of Galatians in the sense that when you're looking at the book of Hebrews, it seems as if the Hebrew writer is dealing basically or primarily with first century Christians that had came from a Jewish background. When you look at the book of Galatians, notice, if you will, that Paul is dealing with Christians that had come from a pagan background as well as a Jewish background. So you had a little bit different approach the way Paul approached Galatians as opposed to the way the Hebrew writer approached the book of Hebrews. Remember, we started out making the point that he was going to make a series of arguments throughout the book of Hebrews. And we've noticed how that has come about. Remember, if you will, we started out talking about that the Hebrew writer made the argument that the Son of God was superior to the angels. And then, remember, if you will, he made the argument that the Son of God was superior to Moses. Remember also, if you will, he made the argument that the Son of God was a superior high priest. Then he made the point that the Son of God had a superior covenant and a superior priesthood. Now what we're doing now and what we're looking at in chapters 9 and 10 is the fact that he is making the point that the priesthood, what he's doing in chapters 9 and 10 is that he's making the point that the priesthood is far superior to the priesthood of old. So now you put all of that together, and what we're doing is we are comparing and contrasting the old law to the new. Now, notice, if you will, that when you're doing that, what the Hebrew writer is trying to do is show that the New Testament Christians today are living under a superior covenant, serving under a superior priest, and having a superior priesthood. So we're getting to that section in the book of Hebrews where we're basically closing out that fundamental argument that he makes throughout the book. Now, as we enter into the latter part of Hebrews chapter 10, all through the remaining part of the book of Hebrews, he's basically going to make the argument that since we're living under those principles, then there is a great deal of expectations by the Son of God on our behalf. And the last few chapters of the book of Hebrews is going to be an encouragement for us to recognize the superiority of what we're living under, and to live as such, and to encourage such. Now notice, if you will, when you start into the 9th chapter of the book of Hebrews, Hebrews, and as we said, it's fairly lengthy. It's got 28 verses in it. Probably be beneficial to kind of divide it up into about three sections. For example, we'll begin in Hebrews 9:1, and we'll go through verse 5. When we finish discussing that, we'll begin looking at verses 6, and we'll go through verse 10. And then once we've talked about that, we'll begin in verse 11, go through verse 14, and then we'll begin in verse 15, go through verse 23, then close out the chapter starting with verse 24 going through verse 28. So when you kind of break it into those sections, I think we'll notice that it flows much easier, and we can kind of see the arguments that he's making. Remember, if you will, he closed out chapter 8, verse 13, by saying, "A new covenant he hath made the first whole. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away." Remember, if you will, on Wednesday night, we talked about, as we looked at the 8th chapter of the book of Hebrews, that this new covenant was basically prophesied by Jeremiah. Back in Jeremiah chapter 31, beginning in verse 31. We also talked about why this old covenant was getting old, that it was going to be vanishing away, it was going to be disappearing. And we said, number one, as we'll notice when we go through the latter part of chapter 9, number one, it could not save. Number two, it was broken by the very people that it was given to. Remember, if you will, we talked about how Moses led the children of Israel out of Egyptian captivity. They crossed the Red Sea. They went down to Mount Sinai, and they spent 1 year around that mountain. While Moses was going up and down that mountain, and God was giving Moses the law. What law? This covenant that he gave to these people. And remember, if you will, when we were studying that section of the Old Testament, how excited they were. Oh yes, we're thankful. We're a special people. God's delivered us out of bondage, and now he's given us a law. Why, surely we'll keep it. How long did they keep it? And not very long. They broke it before God gave it to them good. And they broke that covenant. And remember, if you will, that whole generation of people, once they were given the law, once they were given the instructions as to how to build the tabernacle, how to furnish the tabernacle, how to move the tabernacle, once they were given the instructions as to how to organize themselves after they had established the priesthood from the tribe of Levi and had gathered themselves and were preparing to leave to go into Canaan's fair land, what happened?
They didn't go in.
They never went in. Why?
They believed the tent instead of the two.
Yes, they believed the tent instead of the two. They did not go in because of unbelief. And one whole generation died and was buried out there in the wilderness, and their children, under the leadership of Joshua, went into the land of Canaan. Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey. That's one of the arguments of the Hebrew writer. Don't be like those people. Don't lose what you have in Christ Jesus. You have a better covenant, a better priesthood, a better priest. Don't give that up to go back and live under a covenant that cannot save, that timber for the tabernacle. All of that is going to be destroyed. Remember, they were given the instructions, as we said, back in Sinai. They knew exactly how to build that tabernacle. And God instructed Moses, and he says, you build that tabernacle exactly according to the pattern that I gave you on the mountain. So they knew exactly how to build it. They knew exactly how to furnish it. They knew exactly how to pack it up, move it from location to location. They knew the purpose of that tabernacle. And they knew that God would be in their presence when the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies. So they knew the significance of it. Remember, if you will, later on in Israel's history, David came up with the plan. He says, I'd like to build a permanent structure of worship for my people. And he said, they need to worship in something better than a tent. And that's typically what this tabernacle was. It was a tent that could be moved from one location to the other. David was told, no, you're not going to be able to build it because you've shed too much blood, but I will allow your son Solomon to build it. Now, the temple itself was laid out on the basic same pattern as was the tabernacle, because it was the place of worship. And remember, if you will, when the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, there was the Ark of the Covenant, there was the cherubims. They were in the presence of God when they went into that section. But it was just a type. It was but a figure of the good things that was to come. And as Jeremiah said in Jeremiah 31, going to give a new covenant. And the Hebrew writer says, okay, guess what? The old one is about ready to vanish away. Well, remember, if you will, it started when Jesus nailed it to the cross, when he died on the cross, was placed in that tomb, and came out and ascended back to heaven. But it really was brought to an end when the king of Rome sent his armies down to Jerusalem, and they surrounded the city and fulfilled the prophecy that Jesus made back in Matthew 24 when he looked down upon that mountainside in the city of Jerusalem and told his disciples there's not going to be one stone left undone. When they got through some 2 years later, there's not a Jew that lives today that can trace their inheritance. The records were destroyed. Everything was crushed, brought down. And as he said, the temple was destroyed, the city was destroyed, the Jewish people as a whole endured great grief, great heartache, great destruction. Now we begin the first five verses. And notice how he said, this covenant that is old and decayed and ready to vanish away, the first covenant had ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary. Now I want you to think for just a moment. He's saying that this first covenant was what kind of covenant? Okay. What kind of sanctuary did it have? A worldly sanctuary. In other words, it was worldly in organization. For there was a tabernacle made. The first wherein was the candlestick and the table and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. After the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid round about with gold, wherein was the golden pot that had manna and Aaron's rod that budded at the tabernacles of the covenant. And over it, the cherubims of glory shadowing the mercy seat, of which we cannot now speak particularly. Now remember, if you will, when we were looking through and studying the book of Exodus and the book of Leviticus, we read and studied about this procedure and how it came about. And of course, this arrangement, as we said a few moments ago, it was temporary in nature, because this one would be replaced by a spiritual house, not a house made from the city of Jerusalem in the sense that it was made with literal hands, but we're talking about a spiritual house. And what the Hebrew writer is going to do is, he goes through the ninth chapter, he's going to be comparing and contrasting. You know, these priests came from the Levitical priesthood, from the tribe of Levi. But remember now, these people, the Hebrew Christians, were living under a different priesthood. Where did their high priest come from? Where does our high priest come from? From what tribe? Of who was the tribe of Judah? David. Not only is he a high priest, remember we looked at Zechariah chapter 6 and they made a prophecy about this new priesthood? And they made a dual crown, and they set this crown upon the priest, symbolic of the fact that this would be not only a priest, but also a king. Now they used another example later on. Who did they use and say, this priest is, and this king is going to be like who? Melchizedek of old. Because there was no beginning. There was no end. What would happen to these Old Testament priests?
They would die.
They would die. And they would have to be replaced. But this high priest was going to live forever. He was going to be an eternal priest, and this priesthood was going to be eternal. So he kind of draws out something they could be familiar with, the Old Testament tabernacle and the makeup of that tabernacle, and talked about how that it was a worldly thing, but now we're going to be talking about a spiritual arrangement that's far superior. Look at verse 6. When these things were thus ordained, the priest went always into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God. But into the second went the high priest alone once every year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people. The Holy Spirit thus signified that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, while as the first tabernacle was yet standing. What is the Hebrew writer saying here? What do you mean it's not yet made manifest?
Well, they'll all still affect Christ in that time. Once Christ comes, and it's going to be, the old one's going to be torn down.
Absolutely. It could not be brought into effect until what? The old one was done away with. You see, that's the reason he said, look, it's waxing old, it's decaying. You know, it's been broken anyway, and Jeremiah said, we're going to get a new one. But the new one couldn't come until the old one was done away with. Now, it's not uncommon to study with people today. And one of the first things that you've got to do before you can really have a good study of the Bible, you've got to understand the makeup of the Bible, the divisions of the Bible. For example, there was the patriarchal dispensation that started from the creation itself and went right on down through Abraham. And remember, Abraham was given a promise. Abraham was told, says, now Abraham, you're going to have so many children, they're going to be like the stars of the heaven, sand and sea. But they said, these people are going to go into captivity for 400 years. Well, we've just been talking about the ending of that and Moses taking them out of captivity and down to Mount Sinai. That started the Mosaical dispensation. Or the Mosaical age. And of course, it came and went through the end of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when Jesus died on the cross of Calvary, was placed in that borrowed tomb, was raised from the dead. And when Peter stood up on Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, preached that first gospel sermon, this new dispensation, the Christian era, the Christian age came into existence, this new covenant that Jeremiah said, it's coming. But the old had to be done away first because they both couldn't coexist together. One of the greatest problems you have in helping people to understand that this book we call the Bible is a book about God, sin, and redemption is to understand that the Old Testament was done away and the New was still, that is now in existence, and that we are living under the New. Does that mean the Old is not any good? Why, certainly not. Do we need to know it? We certainly do. Because it brings us and helps us to understand how blessed we are to live under a new covenant that was given specifically to us and those that live under that dispensation. And we see how superior it is to the old. Now, notice, if you will, that's the reason so many people say, oh, well, we're still living under the old. And what does that lead to? Well, they'll pick something out they like in the Old Testament. And they'll just slide it into the worship today and say, well, they did it under the old. We can do it today. Well, no, because we're living under a different covenant. And just as Moses was told, Moses, there's a pact. I'm going to tell you exactly how to build that tabernacle. I'm going to tell you exactly how to make the stuff to go in that tabernacle. And I'm going to tell you exactly how I want you to worship when you come in that tabernacle. I want there to be priests. Now, some of these priests from the tribe of Levi, they're just going to be able to go into part of this temple, this tabernacle. But this high priest, once a year, he's going to go in the Holy of Holies and he's going to make a blood sacrifice for himself and then for you to roll your sins forward another year. While you wait for this new covenant that's far superior, that's going to be able to remove, we're going to notice in a few moments, the very conscience of sin itself. Have you ever seen people talk to people that once they become a Christian and it seems as if it's harder for them to forgive themselves than it is for God, who should send his son to this earth and allowed him to die on the cross of Calvary to make redemption possible? Well, the Hebrew writer is going to say, look, this superior God has the ability to provide you with the means to soothe your guilt, to cleanse, to purge your conscience. Now he's going to go on. And he said in verse 9, talking about this old system, it was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered gifts and sacrifices, that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience, which stood only in meats and drinks and divers washings and carnal ordinances imposed on them until the time of Reformation. Well, little do we begin the book of Matthew, and we get down to the 19th chapter of the book of Matthew, and the sinless Son of God who came to this earth to die on the cross of Calvary begins to talk about the power of regeneration. Remember in John chapter 3, you've got to be born again. You've got to be born from above. You've got to be born of the water and the Spirit to enjoy this regeneration process and to be able to enter this spiritual kingdom, this spiritual tabernacle, this spiritual body that's so far superior than that old tabernacle. And then we get to the third chapter of the book of Acts. And they begin to talk about the times of refreshing, the times of regeneration, and the times of refreshing is here. Oh, it could not happen under that old system. But it says in verse 11, Christ, being come a high priest of good things to come by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building, neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood he entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us. In other words, this sacrifice was so superior, so far advanced, so different in that old system that this man Jesus left heaven, took upon himself the form of a servant, was made in the likeness of man, and being found in fashion as a man, humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God had highly exalted him, given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow. Oh, he's not like that high priest of old that would live for a generation and die, and that would have to offer a sacrifice for himself because he was a sinner just like the people he was offering sacrifices for. Oh, we've got a different. We've got a different high priest that only had to go in one time and make one sacrifice that was so far superior than all of the Old Testament sacrifices. Can you imagine how many gallons of blood had been shed over generation after generation after generation waiting for that ultimate sacrifice? It would probably reach the peaks of the highest mountains that we could find in the United States of America. But that one sacrifice was made. And the old sacrifices couldn't do the job anyway. It says, for if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctified to the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ through the eternal Spirit offer himself one. How beautiful to think about that we're living under that dispensation, and that before the world was created, before God put Adam and Eve in the garden, he could foresee and foreknow that sin was going to separate them from himself and separate us from him. And he had the plan. In his mind, Paul referred to it to the Ephesian brethren as the manifold wisdom of God, talking about his kingdom, his spiritual kingdom of church, of life, that gathering together under the old system. Now, what's so sad about it, you see, we really need to be able to communicate this information with our friends, especially those that come from a denominational background, Because the denominational world as we know it today, their whole teaching philosophy is based on two principles. Total hereditary depravity. That being, they believe that they inherit the sins of their moms and the dads. They're totally depraved. And God has chosen one group to be saved and another group to be lost, and there is nothing either group can do to change the outcome. You're either going to be saved, you're either going to be lost. The other basic principle, you've probably heard about, you've talked to them, and that's the doctrine of premillennialism. Now that doctrine teaches that Jesus has never set up his kingdom. Oh, he came, but he was rejected by the Jews. And he's coming back one day in the future, and he's going to sit down in the city of Jerusalem, and he's going to establish his kingdom, and he's going to reign 1,000 years from the city of Jerusalem. And they're going to bring back all of what we've saw and read about right here that won't do anything to save us. All that's coming back. I read an article about 5 or 10 years ago. And there was a group of people. They were raising. Have you ever read about that red heifer he's talked about? It's amazing to go back and look at the details for these red heifers that they had to offer. But it had to be blemish free. And there was a group of people that had decided they couldn't find any of these red heifers to offer. So they were going to breed and raise some of these red heifers so when Christ came back, they'd have a red heifer to offer. That's sad. When the sinless Son of God left heaven and died on the cross of Calvary and shed his blood so that another red heifer would never have to be offered again, nor the blood of bulls and goats or any other sacrifice. That he was going to establish his kingdom by the shedding of his blood. Now notice, if you will, he begins in verse 15 and following to say, because of this cause, he is a mediator of a New Testament. Isn't that beautiful? He's our stand between. He's our holy lawyer. Remember when he came, he was led out in the wilderness and he was tempted. He was tempted like as we. So he can sympathize with us. He knows us. He can carry on a conversation between him and God the Father to plead our case for us, because he is our mediator. Well, this cause he's the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death for the redemption of the transgression that was under the first testament, they which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. In other words, this sacrifice was so powerful that the blood that was shed would go back and cover people like Abraham, who died in faith. We're going to get to the 11th chapter here pretty soon. It's going to talk about a group of people that lived under those old covenants, that lived by faith, believing that in the future a time would come when this person would come, would die on the cross, would make this ultimate sacrifice. He says in verse 17, a testament is a force after the men are dead. Otherwise, it is no strength at all while the testator lives. Now, we can relate to that. We know how wills work. And if you go make out a will, you can change it 10 times between now and the time that you pass this life out into eternity. But the last one you make, it goes into effect. Now notice, if you will, he goes on in verses 20 and following and said, this is the blood of the New Testament which God hath enjoined unto you. sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. Almost all things are of the law purged with blood. Without shedding blood, there's no remission. It was therefore necessary that the patterns of things in the heavens should be purified with these things, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these for Christ. Is not entered into the holy places made with hands, which are the figures of the truth, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God Christ. Beautiful, beautiful language, right? That we now have a high priest unlike the high priest of old. All they could do is sprinkle blood over all of those things in the tabernacle. All they could do was sprinkle blood and make blood sacrifices on the altar on a temporary basis. What was it going to take? It was going to take the death, the burial, and the resurrection. And when he was raised from the dead, he ascended back up into the heavens above. He's now sitting down at the right hand of God. He's now our King and our High Priest and our Mediator. And it required that this to put this final covenant into existence. That's going to last as long as this world lasts. Now notice how he closes it out. Nor yet that he should offer himself often as the high priest entered the holy place every year with the blood of others. For then must he often have suffered since the foundation of the world. But now, once in the end of the world have he appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice. Now look how he closes it out. It's appointed unto one. It's appointed unto man once to die, but after this the judgment. So Christ was once offered to bear the sins of men. And unto them that look for him shall he appear the second time without sin unto salvation. This man came apart from sin. And what he's trying to get across to these Hebrew writers, don't leave the faith. Don't give up your faith and go back and live under that old law that's been done away with, that was nailed to the cross, that could not save. Be with those that are waiting. Be with those that are looking for. Be with those that are going to enjoy that eternal salvation throughout the eternal ages. He died once. He was raised from the dead. He was justified that we might be justified. And these Hebrew writers needed to know, you need to wait. Don't need to give up. You need to stay faithful. How does that message apply to us? We need to do the same thing. Now, we'll pick up in a few moments looking at a lesson from the book of Hebrews about purging our conscience from sin.